Hello, and welcome to the Lies.com podcast for Friday, March 17th, 2006. It is St. Patrick's Day. I missed last week's podcast recording. Why was that? Because I stayed home from work on Friday. I mean, I worked at home on Friday because Linda had injured her back. Well, she had a flare-up of sciatica that I guess she had been ignoring for a few weeks, and it got really excruciating, and so I was working from home so I could do kid duty, driving kids around so she could avoid having to drive the car for a few days. And that seems to have worked really well. She's feeling much better now. It was her birthday yesterday, which is always a good reason to feel better. Between the delay since my last podcast and the long delay prior to that, during which time I had recorded a podcast but not actually finished the small amount of work needed to get it up on lies.com. It's been probably a good 5 or 6 weeks since I actually recorded one of these. And there's certainly been a lot of comment-worthy incidents during that time, things that if I had been more regularly posting on lies.com or even recording podcasts, I would certainly have felt compelled to comment on. Something of a target-rich environment these days for a person with my particular obsessions. So in this podcast, I'm going to try and talk about a few of those things, along with random excursions into whatever other things happen to catch my attention. I guess, as is usual, I will start with my bush bashing. And there's been just a ton of stuff, sort of wacky stories. And I have a comment on the Bush administration's ability to generate wacky stories generally, that I guess I'll get to shortly. But I should touch first on the specifics of some of these wacky stories. Some of them are old news at this point, and I apologize for dredging them up again, but since I haven't had the opportunity until now to yak about them, and I do have a few things I feel like saying about them, I'll just trot that out now. But apologies in advance. If you find this sort of thing boring and disgusting, you should just fast forward, I guess, through this part of the podcast. One thing I missed my chance to talk about was Cheney's hunting accident, where he shot his friend in the face and chest with his shotgun as he was quail hunting. I know this has been covered a lot, but, you know, to me, the interesting thing about that whole story was what it revealed about the Bush administration, and in particular, in particular Cheney's office, their just intense focus on managing the flow of information and spinning events and controlling the media's coverage of events, without really knowing more about what really happened. And again, as a result of this intense managing of the story from the Cheney side, I don't think we really do know really what happened there. But from what we did hear about it, it certainly seems like the kind of thing that didn't need to be spun, that, you know, an appearance by Cheney and or Bush saying the same things that Cheney eventually said in his interview with whoever it was at Fox News. And this would have been pretty much a non-story, or at least the use of it as a stick to beat on the Bush administration for their penchant for secrecy would have not been there. But of course, that does raise the question that if they went to such effort to conceal it, you know, how can we comfortably trust them? How can we comfortably assume that the version of events that they presented was actually accurate? You know, we had the example that the ranch owner who made the initial report to the local paper and provided some of the early interviews on the incident, you know, her stories really didn't jive. She said things that were not consistent. She said that, you know, I forget. There were two or three points that, if you looked at what she actually said and compared it to things she said at other times, really couldn't be reconciled with each other. Things about what she did and didn't see, you know. And of course, there was that unseemly effort to portray it as somehow the fault of the guy who got shot. Which Cheney did, you know, own up to later on in the process and acknowledged after having, you know, presided over some aggressive spin seeking to state, you know, to create the impression that it was otherwise, but acknowledging that it was his fault. Anyway, I don't know. It's just the kind of thing that, I mean, I guess my assumption is that the reason why it came in for such an aggressive spin job was that it resonates symbolically. You know, you had Cheney, who was the leading cheerleader for the invasion of Iraq, an incident that involved the application of deadly force in a way that turned out to be horribly irresponsible, in the sense that the justification for it that we were assured over and over again was a slam dunk, turned out to be false. And there's certainly fingerprints of the vice president's office all over the trumping up of the case against Saddam Hussein regarding weapons of mass destruction. You know, so we have that, and then you compare that with the incident with the quail hunting, where you basically have the vice president making this decision to use deadly force on the basis of a mistaken set of assumptions about what he was actually shooting at and whether or not there was an innocent party standing in front of his shotgun. It has a certain degree of resonance there, just symbolically, you know, just metaphorically. But, you know, that's enough with the Bush administration to qualify for the full application of the resources of the presidency to try to craft an impression in the public mind that runs in a different direction, to try and control public perception with propaganda, you know, with hardcore spinning, steady and repetitive spinning. Anyway, and it was unseemly seeing the reporters going after them on it, because there's this, you know, it's like this dance. It's like you've got Scott McClellan up there at the podium saying bullshit and saying the same bullshit over and over and over again. You've got the reporters basically asking question after question, trying to expose the nature of that bullshit. But in terms of what they're overtly saying on both sides, they're kind of dancing around the actual, you know, the dead body in the middle of the room, which is that this is an effort to spin public opinion. And the White House tries to spin it one way, and the media tries to resist being spun. But, you know, they both end up looking really ridiculous, and it's just unseemly. It's the mud wrestling that is politics, but is very, very much the politics of the Bush administration. So we had the shooting story. What other stuff went on? I know there were at least two or three other stories. There was this kind of minor story about the video footage surfacing showing Bush being briefed about Katrina the weekend of the hurricane's landfall. And it really did belie the statements he made later about, oh, no one thought the levees would be breached. And so now we get into these kind of ridiculous talking points. You know, I think we're going to have to retire the characterization of minute parsing of meanings of words as a Clintonian parsing of, you know, what the definition of is. Because really we've got more and better examples from the Bush administration now. In this case, the distinction that some Republican apologists tried to make between the president's statement that nobody thought the levees would be breached with the on-camera, it turns out, briefing of the president to the effect that there was a grave risk that the levees would be overtopped. That, you know, there's some distinction there that, well, of course Bush knew they'd be overtopped, but nobody expected they'd actually be breached as a result of that. Well, no, that's not really true. It's just more spin. Spin, spin, spin. Another story that I thought was interesting was the, of course, the Claude Allen arrest. Claude Allen, someone that, you know, frankly, even with my fairly significant obsession in the Bush administration, I had no idea who Claude Allen was when this story broke. I didn't really pay attention when he resigned, and whenever it was in January or February, citing a desire to spend more time with his family. Although it is pretty rich in hindsight that, you know, that very tired explanation was offered, that, you know, you've got this young, accomplished, successful guy, one of the top advisors in the White House, basically at the top of the White House pay grade, pulling down like $161,000 a year, choosing to suddenly leave his job with no job waiting for him, and doing it kind of abruptly, and citing the desire to spend more time with his family as the reason. That really is a red flag in Washington that you've got some sort of scandal that we don't know about yet. And of course, it turns out that was the case. It was shortly after, this happened shortly after he'd been questioned by police in connection with this bizarre pseudo kind of shoplifting behavior where he'd go into the Target store and he'd buy a bunch of items, take them out to his car, stick them in the trunk, then go back into the store with his receipt and an empty bag, an empty shopping bag, take all those same items off the shelf, and then go up to the returns desk with his receipt and return them all, get the money refunded to his credit card. And the question of why somebody making $161,000 a year, a top advisor in the White House, would do something like that is, it's really remarkable. There's been some, there was some story, I can't remember what it was, about some right-wing commentator floating the suggestion that it was actually Alan's twin brother, that there was some involvement of his twin brother in this, that actually Alan could be innocent, could be protecting his brother. I'm not aware that anybody's offered any actual evidence of that. And in the absence of any evidence of that being offered, I think we'd have to say, well, if that's what's going on, then it's a noble thing he's doing, taking the blame. But as long as he's doing it, the blame is his. You know, it's not like you can just raise that possibility through a surrogate and somehow escape the blame. Somehow the blame gets lost, and then nobody's responsible. Yay! Although that would certainly be consistent with the operation of many others in the Bush administration from the top on down. I did think it was interesting, the story of, the big kind of question there, the substantive question there to me is, well, did the White House know, did Bush know what was going on there? Supposedly, Alan had a discussion with Andrew Card and he told him, back before all this, before the arrest happened, that the police had contacted the White House, but supposedly only to verify his employment there or something like that back in January. When he was first, observed and this investigation was launched by the police. And supposedly, Alan assured them, oh, it's just some mix-up. I changed addresses or my credit card bills went awry or something like that. And I could accept that the White House just took that story at face value. He's a top advisor. I could see them basically just taking him at face value on that. But it's an odd, it looks a little bit odd. I find myself wondering, well, when did the White House really know? Their response when it actually came out had the, it just smelled to me like a prearranged, again, this sort of dance. It was like a prearranged ritual we were going through, the requisite time having elapsed between his departure to spend more time with his family and then the shocked realization by the White House along with everybody else that, oh my gosh, look, this, he had this secret life going on, this secret criminal behavior that he was engaging in. I don't know. With any other administration at this point, with any other recent administration at this point, I'd probably give them the benefit of the doubt on that. But the Bush administration, I don't think they qualify for any benefit of the doubt at this point. That's not just animus on my part. That's repeated experience. You see somebody lie to you enough times, and you start to assume when there's some degree of uncertainty that, he's lying. And I don't think that's unwarranted. I don't think it's unreasonable. I just do not trust the Bush administration at this point. Or rather, I trust them. I'm dead certain that in any situation, they'll be motivated maybe, 2-3% by the desire to fully and honestly convey information and, 97-98% by the desire to spin the facts in whatever way makes them look best. And deflects blame and minimizes any chance they would be held responsible for any errors in judgment or mistakes. But anyway, I did think it was interesting that at least I may have missed it, but I don't think The Daily Show actually covered the Claude Allen story at all. I was watching for it. There was a gap there because it came when Jon Stewart was out in Hollywood doing his Oscar hosting. But I don't remember seeing anything about the Claude Allen story. And if true, I would give them points for that, that they looked at it and decided, this is actually just a personal tragedy and not so funny, not worth making a joke about. I'd actually lump that together with another, with something I saw on The Daily Show. It was actually one of the best things I've seen in a while. I don't watch the show all the time these days. I just, you know, don't have time for it. But when I do catch it occasionally, it's certainly worth a look. And the story I remember that I just loved, I had sat down with Julia and Linda, and we turned on The Daily Show, and we're watching the episode, and a segment came on with Ed Helms, who's, you know, one of my favorites at doing those interviews where he just sort of takes the interviewer in this sarcastic direction. My favorite single thing from The Daily Show, I think, that I've ever seen. Well, there's a lot of favorites, but one of my favorites was Ed Helms interviewing the young telephone canvasser for some libertarian group in Washington State or Oregon or somewhere. And he was saying, well, let's role play. I'll be someone that you're calling, and you try to, you know, give me your pitch. And so as they're doing the phone call, Ed Helms adopts the voice of some, you know, 90-year-old guy who's saying stuff like, I'm only talking to you because I'm lonely. It was just very funny. It doesn't sound funny as I repeat it, but just in the context and as it developed with him and this you know, earnest young libertarian phone bank guy, it was good stuff, good comedy. Anyway, so Ed Helms did this segment with Paul Hackett. Paul Hackett, the, you know, the Marine officer who returned from Iraq to run for Congress against presumably very safe Republican district in Ohio, and scared the Republican Party generally, and certainly the incumbent in that district, by getting pretty close. He lost, but he, you know, scored a historic high for a Democrat in that district. And the specifics of Hackett's criticisms I love, because he's basically saying the things about the Iraq War that I and a lot of other people have been saying from the outset. And, you know, it gets dismissed as sort of moveon.org peacenik rhetoric by the people who cling desperately to some sort of argument, the ever-changing argument as circumstances remove their old arguments, but some sort of argument in defense of the war in Iraq. That sort of talk gets dismissed like that, but those charges really don't seem to stick with Hackett. And just, you know, in the face of the Democratic Party's spinelessness, the unwillingness, I mean, first off, the willingness of so many Democrats to vote in favor of the war at the outset, and their unwillingness now to acknowledge, you know, the way the Bush administration is able to hold them hostage, in effect, with their own prior approval of the war, giving them basically the same business they gave Kerry during the last presidential campaign, that, well, you know, you said we could go to war, so it doesn't matter if it was this terrible debacle, you're involved too, you can't criticize it now, because you're criticizing yourself, na 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 na. And it's just so childish and so destructive of any kind of rational, mature response to a failed policy. And Hackett's approach to that is so refreshing. He is just so honest, brutally honest, and legitimately pissed. And with his background, his credentials, you know, he was there. He was there fighting the war. There is no way on earth that any of these chicken hawks who support the war can come after him as somehow hypocritical. You know, Hackett put his life on the line. And his presentation is just spot on. He's great. So anyway, so this segment starts, and it centers on Hackett. You know, he was had entered the race for Senate in Ohio, and the Democratic Party basically talked him into backing out of the race. They withdrew any support from him, and I don't know what all the details were. I know it was a little bit ugly that they basically supported his Democratic opponents, you know, his opponents for the Democratic nomination, and made it clear that if he pursued it, he would be persona non grata in terms of the Democratic Party. So he backed off. But the Daily Show segment involved an interview with I don't know what his role was, but some big muckety-muck in the Democratic machine, and Paul Hackett. And the sarcasm was being laid on so thick. It was just a great, great segment. If you haven't seen it, I totally encourage you to see it, where Hackett, you know, comes off like he does, as plain-spoken and correct, and the Democratic tool comes off as a tool, and it was just so damning. I mean, in a serious way. I mean, it was humorous, and it was, you know, there was a lot of subtle and not-so-subtle irony going on in the way Ed Helms handled it. But at heart, it was such a devastating attack, seriously, on the integrity of the Democratic Party and its political aims and its means of pursuing those aims. I mean, I found that part of it really disgusting, and there is no way that I will. I'm certainly not going to be easing up my criticisms of the Bush administration and those in the Republican Party who support it, because I think he's hands down the worst president of my lifetime, going well beyond Richard Nixon. He's the worst president ever that I can tell, and that's saying a lot. He's just horribly unsuited for the office for so many reasons. But at the same time, the Democratic Party is undeserving of my support to the extent that they're unwilling to support someone like Paul Hackett. And, you know, the people that are actually pushing in the Democratic machine I'm not impressed by. I'm just not impressed. You know, thinking about it more, I regret. I mean, there wasn't any, you know, Dean dropped out of the running in the last election, but and certainly Kerry was a far superior candidate to George Bush, and we'd be much better off with him as president than George Bush. But, you know, that's not someone I'm going to lay down my own political capital for in the future. I've been there, I've done that, and the Democratic Party has squandered a lot of that political capital that I would have vested with them in the name of stopping George Bush. Anyway, that was a side excursion I didn't really intend to take. But watching Paul Hackett, it was great. And it was also great that he basically was in on the joke. He basically went with at the end of the segment, you see him basically, Ed Helms is coaching him as a political advisor, is coaching Paul Hackett on how to present himself and how to say things to be more electable, more like the mainstream Democratic Party. And it was funny stuff. It was really good. Left me thinking, you know, Jesus, Paul Hackett, you're better than these people, you know? Screw running for office as a Democrat. Run for president in 2008 as an independent. And yeah, you won't win, but, you know, there's some fights it's better to join, even if the end isn't victory. You know, in the long run, maybe it does take you somewhere better. I don't know. I would vote for someone like Paul Hackett. I would go out and canvass for someone like Paul Hackett. I won't be doing that for someone like, you know, John Kerry in 2008. I'd certainly do it for Al Gore, based on the kinds of speeches he's been giving. I'd, you know, possibly do it for someone like Hillary. I don't know. I mean, that starts to get me back into the realm of the kinds of people I'm not really thrilled about, the way they're running the party. Support for the Iraq War pretty much becomes a litmus test for me. You know, if you're venal enough to do that, you're not worthy of my trust and not worthy of my vote. I had the pleasure of seeing my congressperson, Congresswoman Lois Capps, Democrat of Santa Barbara. She was at an event, a fundraising event that Linda was involved in organizing, a fundraiser for my son William's school. It's a public elementary school. It's very small. It's got about 5 or 6 classrooms in it, you know, tiny little school. And they had this annual fundraiser. They raised like, I don't know, $60,000 or something. They did really well. But Lois Capps was there. She spoke briefly at the outset. And I didn't find out until a few days later that she had actually recently signed on as one of the co-sponsors of a bill seeking to explore impeachment of George Bush. And if I had known that at the time, I would have overcome my normal shyness and unwillingness to bother people who are already being bothered by lots of other people, and would have braved the crowd and got up there and thanked her personally for that. I think it showed a lot of courage. I think it shows a lot of courage that she voted against the Iraq War resolution in 2002, one of the few with the willingness to do that. And, you know, it could well be said, one of the few with a safe enough district in Santa Barbara that she could get away with making a vote like that and continue to hold office. But I give her the benefit of the doubt that she made that vote not merely out of a political calculation, but out of a willingness to do the right thing, regardless of what that cost was. Well, I'm coming up on the time to turn off my recording, which is unfortunate because I had a bunch of other stuff I wanted to talk about besides all this political stuff. I still didn't get to my promised commentary about what this all means in the big picture. Bush administration, the response to the Cheney shooting, the response to the Claude Allen story. I don't know, just all. I mean, I've said it before. It doesn't really bear repeating, probably. But the new poll came out about Bush recently that the single word that the public overwhelmingly associates with his name now, that most commonly appears in, like, you know, 45%+, a big plurality of respondents, you ask them what single word best describes the Bush in his approach to the presidency, and the word they gave was incompetent, which is true. I mean, they are horribly incompetent, and it is really their distinguishing feature. But if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty, they're not universally incompetent. They're incompetent at actual governance. They're incompetent at the policy aspects of what they do, at making wise decisions, making decisions that are good decisions in terms of their outcomes, where they're completely confident. I mean, any politician, you know, you have this tension between politics and policy. You have this tension between the things you do in order to secure, in order to gain and hold on to political power. Right? And this is the politics. This is the, you know, log rolling and quid pro quos and how you spin things and, you know, your public appearance and symbolism and all that. There's the politics side. And then there's the policy side. There's, you know, the actual process of getting together and doing the work of government, making the key decisions. You know, do we invade Iraq or not? Do we bomb Iran or not? Do we, you know, push for a prescription drug benefit under Medicare or not? You know, all these kinds of things, you know, these policy issues. And what the Bush administration epitomizes is the complete victory of the political side of the office of the president over the policy-making side. That, you know, in any presidency, there's this tension, and the politics side gains power at the expense of the policy-making side during the actual campaigns. But ideally, you know, once you've actually won office, the policymakers get the ascendancy, or at least get more of more seats at the table in terms of determining what you're actually going to spend your political capital on. But what the Bush administration, I think, will be known for is the complete victory of the politics over policy, that the campaign never ends with the Bush administration and can't end, really. You know, as I analyze, you know, where does this come from, I think it really comes from the fact that he is horribly, horribly unqualified to be president and just has no business being in that office, such that the only reason he's there is that he has this total commitment to politics, this total commitment to doing, saying whatever it takes to win. You know, I'm convinced there's so many different things he does that I won't go into it now. I've talked about him before, and I'm sure I'll talk about them again. It's interesting to see his poll numbers. You know, he's at historic lows now. He's down in the 30s, mid to low 30s, pretty much in all the major polls now. And that's pretty shockingly low. And it's interesting to me how it's gone. I mean, when word came out about his domestic wiretapping, you know, which is arguably an impeachable offense with no decent legal rationale that I can see having been offered in defense of it. But he aggressively spun it as, you know, him standing up to the terrorists and his opponents wanting to let Al-Qaeda attack us in the name of some, you know, nominal adherence to quaint, outdated notions of civil liberties. He successfully, you know, made that case to the public, at least in the sense that his poll numbers actually went up a little bit. You know, if you look at the then 40% or so of the country still willing to say they supported George Bush, those people liked hearing that. They were receptive to that kind of talk. Those people who were on the bubble with Bush at that point, that worked for them. You know, that argument worked. And interestingly, it was then the Dubai ports deal where, arguably, I think Bush talked sense for the first time in a long time. Now, granted, he only talked sense about the Dubai ports deal because he got caught flat-footed, having ignored the discussion, you know, and people within his department made the correct choice that, yeah, it was okay to have these guys running the ports, or at least, you know, a defensible choice. Having been caught flat-footed and then unwilling, of course, to admit any error, Bush came out strongly in support of that decision after the fact, when it started to become a controversy. And then, having taken a position, you know, in his stubborn way, would refuse to back down until his, you know, high-powered friends, you know, talked to their high-powered friends in Dubai, and they kind of carefully cleaned things up. Again, the classic George Bush blunder aftermath of his powerful friends kind of helping him save face, letting him continue to pugnaciously believe that he was correct in making some bonehead decision. At least politically bonehead in this case, and you know, sort of cleaned it up so he wouldn't have to admit he'd been wrong by the Dubai people withdrawing or agreeing to sell off their U.S. assets as part of their acquisition of that British firm. Anyway, so where was I before I started going off on that tangent? Oh, yes. Yeah, so with his poll numbers, that you basically had people like Jimmy Carter coming out saying that Bush was saying the right thing in support of Bush. The very fact that someone like Jimmy Carter was supporting Bush, while you had his, you know, normal allies in Congress in the sort of peckerhead, hard right wing of the Republican Party attacking him using the same sort of xenophobic language that Bush had benefited from over and over and over again. It's the only reason he won re-election was pushing, you know, was playing that sort of reflexive isolationist nationalist card. You know, those people, George Bush actually lost support when you saw some, he actually lost support in terms of the polling when he was saying these sensible things, and you had people like Jimmy, the fact that you had people like Jimmy Carter defending George Bush's position actually cost him points in the polls. Because if you think about it, you know, when you're down to, when Bush is down now to like, you know, mid-30s in terms of poll numbers or 40% in poll numbers, who are those people? Who is it who is still approves of the job that George Bush is doing as president at this stage? You know, given what's happened in Iraq, given what's happened domestically, given all the things that have happened, all the ways in which he has demonstrated his abject incompetence, his abject unsuitability for the office of president. If you are still supporting George Bush at this point, it says volumes about your attitude towards the world and the filter that you perceive reality through. So for those people, George Bush's position on the ports deal was like the kiss of death. You know, they were betrayed. It finally, you know, that succeeded in pulling the curtain aside. You know, forget being willing to wiretap domestically in violation of the Fourth Amendment, you know, gross violation of the Fourth Amendment. Forget that, that's no big deal. But being willing to support letting a bunch of Arabs come in and operate our ports, that was unforgivable. And you saw a sudden drop in his numbers. And again, it's very interesting, you know, in terms of who actually supports Bush at this point. It's not a very attractive group. It's not people that I have any confidence in leading the country. And given that that's the basis of his support, and given that his support has always been based on appealing to his base, it's scary stuff. I mean, if Bush, you know, and the only thing Bush can do at this point to try and secure political capital is to be even more beholden to those sorts of interests than he has been till now. And that's pretty scary. So I talked all this time about George Bush. Really wanted to talk about the Oscars, really wanted to talk about movies, but I really don't think I've got much battery life left in me here, so I'm going to wrap up this edition of the Lies.com podcast. I promise next Friday to put myself on a strict Bush-bashing diet and only talk about him a teensy little bit, and talk more about fun stuff like movies, like the good folks over at the Hollywood Saloon who've put out a couple of podcasts. I've got a hot little Hollywood Saloon podcast waiting on my iPod right now. It's an hour and 44 minutes long, which is so sweet because that is basically the length of my normal commute. Actually, my normal commute plus a little bit. So I'm looking forward to it. On the way home today, that's my ticket. That's going to get me all the way home. So I'm looking forward to that. This Lies.com podcast is copyrighted and is distributed under the Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I am John Callender, and thank you all very much for listening.